stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them.
I would love to introduce you to my guest. His name is Errol Dubler, and we were introduced through another mutual friend, David Ammerland, who wrote The Sniper Mind. And David just spoke so highly of you, so naturally I just had to get you on my podcast. So thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks to David for the introduction. He's been a true mentor. You know, it's funny when we talk about mentors and everybody says they need to have a mentor, and you have to go find a mentor. What I found is they find you. True, real mentors just find you, and David found me, and he's been one of those people who said, I'm just going to help you out and here's what I'm going to do. Never the, tell me what you need. What can, you know, let me know if you need anything. None of those empty comments. He's just always like, here's what I'm doing for you. And here I am. So I'm glad to be here. And thank you,
David. I love that. You know, I've never thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. And as soon as you said that they find you, immediately people that have helped me and helped guide me popped into my head, and they did it without asking to do it or without me having to ask them to do it. I think of Cheryl Snapp Connor, who wrote the foreword for my book, and she's just kind of taken on this role, and it's been such an organic and beautiful relationship ever since. So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, you know, you're welcome. And it's come to light, because if you know, especially when you're starting out in something new, there's, and everybody has good intentions. So this is not to say for everybody listening who has said to me, Errol, let me know if there's anything I can do for you, that I haven't appreciated it and oftentimes taken them up on it. But there is a small difference. And I'm keeping that in mind. You know, when I have young people reach out to me, you know, if I'm either going to be a mentor or not, I'm just going to jump in and do things and go with it. So, yeah.
Oh, I love that. So the reason I wanted to get you on my podcast is because of your new book that you mentioned. And can you just tell us briefly, you know, what that's about?
Yeah, it's called The Process, Art, and Science of Leadership, How Leaders Inspire Confidence and Clarity in Combat, in the Boardroom, and at the Kitchen Table. And it's really just, it's a leadership process that I developed. It's got very specific elements that build on each other. They're not just random thoughts kind of strung together. So everybody should be following these things. Inside of each element, there's an art to it, right? What's good for you is not necessarily going to be good for me, is not going to be necessarily good for somebody else under that specific guideline. And then what I found was later, as I was studying the brain and how the brain rewires itself for positive change, I said, my goodness, this is exciting. My process literally follows the pattern of the brain, right? From emotions to understanding resistance and everything in between. So I added that in. And what I found that to be really great is, you know, sometimes people can be skeptical of a process. And I say, look, this is all I ask is that you take my process for a test drive. And we will work together to figure out what's good for you. But if you're not buying what I'm saying, that's okay. But here's the science behind it. And that usually, if people are on the fence, that puts them on the correct side of going, yeah, I'm really going to go all in on this. So that's the book. And it's really just based on a lifetime of leadership successes and failures and, you know, good, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as it were. And so that's it. It's really a life's work on leadership.
Sounds terrific. I'm really looking forward to reading it. Yep. I love the idea that you can do it from wherever you sit. And mm-hmm. I think that's something people miss. I actually joined my very first professional organization about 7 or 8 years ago. It's called the Women's Leadership Network here in Helena, Montana. And I remember hesitating because it was called Leadership Network, and I didn't feel like I was a leader at the time.
Yeah.
And I think the benefit of just joining anyway was that I became a leader within the organization, ended up being the vice president and president and served on the board for a few years. But what we kept saying as a board was we need to make sure that our community understands that when we say leader, we're not talking about any particular role. We're talking about you can lead from wherever you sit. And I think people forget that.
No, that's exactly right. And that's so, you know, as you go through these things and you say, who's the book for and what's the target audience? You have to have the right answer, right? Essentially, you know, my stock answer is, well, it's business leaders and, you know, people who are leading teams. But really the answer is it's for anybody who cares about leadership. Okay. And there's a difference because you could be a parent and not necessarily care about leadership. Well, then this book isn't for you, right? But you could be a parent and think the most important leadership role I have is for my kids and for my family. Then this book is for you. It's really for anybody who's saying, I care about the impact I have on whoever I'm around, whether that's family, friends, community, or business. To your point, you are a leader anywhere, even if it's a young person, an individual contributor coming up. The premise of my book lends itself to being a better professional individually, and then you will just naturally expand it to your sphere of influence as you grow up the leadership ranks.
So I love this idea of caring about leadership, and that doesn't necessarily imply that they want to be a leader.
That's right.
As a matter of fact, I think some people would really prefer not to consider themselves a leader. And sometimes I think that people like that actually make the best leaders, because it's kind of like people who label themselves influencers, or they label themselves a go-getter, or they label themselves an expert in some field. And my feeling is that if you have to label yourself, then you're not doing it right.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. And there's a lot of truth to it. And what I would say to that is that those people who are reluctant leaders, as it were, they're probably following this process, right? So again, the elements of my process are this: emotional awareness and recognition, because emotions drive our actions. So to be in charge of our actions, we need to understand our emotions fully and wholly. That's the basis of everything. If our actions, by definition, make up our culture, right? Culture is made up of the things you do, not the labels you put on them. So we have to have cultural awareness and recognition. So we go through these first two elements, and it's painful because it's an awareness. How do I feel? What do I do? And I have to look at it without judgment, for better or for worse, because then only then can I start to make those positive change and implement guidelines for behavior, right? So I've got that process. And then we talk about, okay, you've got now how you feel, how you're acting, the behaviors you want to influence your surroundings. And now we have to have a planning process, because in the end, leaders plan. They are judged on mission accomplishment by and large. And I just take a watered down, revised, simplified version of the planning process we used in the SEAL teams. And then the final element is something we just call the resistance, right? If we follow this very logical process of how we feel, what we do, then how, deciding how we want to do it, and then making plans to achieve things, and then understanding the things that derail us, well, it's common sense. So why then will people not do it? And that's the resistance. So when people say they do things instinctively, that's fine. Instincts are great. But the problems with instinct is, as a leader, you can't teach instinct and you can't correct instinct very easily. So if I could put my instinct to a process, and then when things go right, I can look back and say, yeah, here's the things that I did. Okay, I followed this process. Now it's repeatable. When things go wrong with process, we can look back and say, okay, what did I miss? Oh, you know what? I was super emotional and I just didn't take the time to stop and check my emotions and see if that's how I wanted to act. That's where my problem was. So you'll find with those reluctant leaders, they probably just do these things naturally. Okay. And so it's no coincidence.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I'm having a lot of aha moments in the last few weeks about process, because I am not a write it down kind of process person, but it was just recently I realized I do have a process. It's just in my head.
That's right.
And so if I want somebody to help me, if I want to delegate, which is the only way for people to feel really connected to you and the work, I have to better understand how to share that process. And I'll give you an example. When my husband and I were hosting a big gathering with lots of food, and we were catering the whole thing. And a few days before, of course, I had it all in my head. I knew exactly when things needed to be made and how I would prep it and what we needed at the grocery store. Like, I had it all in my head. And my husband said, I want to help you. This is my goal, is to help you. But you have to tell me what is in your head so that I can do that. Just write a list. And it doesn't even have to be an exhaustive list. It doesn't have to be a detailed list. Just write things down for me, and I'll pick out the things that I can do that I can take off your list.
Well, you know, that's the second point. You hit the nail on the head. You can't correct intuition. You can't find out where things went right or wrong, and you also can't teach your intuition. So if you're a leader, if you're leading something, if you are leading setting up a dinner or a banquet, you can't teach your intuition to anybody. They can't read your mind. So you have to be able to verbalize it, and you typically verbalize it through process. The other thing that people get hung up on with the word process is that it's so confining. Oh, Errol, I'm an artist. I process is too confining. I need to be free thinking. And what I remind them is you're separating the big idea or the free flow of ideas from the execution of those big ideas. And in the execution is where we need process, not in the idea, in the brainstorming. That's wide open, right? There's no process to that. Your brain is working. You have an idea. You're trying to formulate it. But when you come to execute that idea, process is very, very important.
Yes. And I think a lot of times people make it far more complicated than it needs to be. And that's where I used to get stuck is, I would get stuck in those details and think that I had to write everything down. Mm-hmm. But really, as my husband said, just write down key phrases, just a list. And I think people don't realize, people like me, who generally don't like process, I have adaptability and activator in my top strengths when it comes to StrengthsFinder. That means that I fly by the seat of my pants. And it comes across as impulsive sometimes. But I also have strategic up there. And I think more people do than don't. They have something in their natural talents that can help them develop process if they stop getting overwhelmed and stuck in the details and the idea that it has to be something really detailed and deliberate. When I think just getting started, just writing down that list makes a huge difference.
Yeah, and that's what we would describe as your art. Right. And I bet if we kept breaking this down, you would see that a lot of your intuition is inside this process. You are checking your emotions, right? Whatever it is, oh, I'm getting bogged down. That's an emotion, right? I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling nervous because why am I getting bogged down? So what do I have to do? How do I have to behave? I have to just get started, right? Because what I am doing is nothing. I'm getting bogged down. So now which behavior? I need to get started, show initiative, whatever it is. And then I bet you in the elements of my planning process, you would cover all of those elements, right? But that's your art. You go through it your own way, right? You have your own certain strengths that you play to, but I promise you it's all inside of this thing. And that's the beauty of what I think my leadership process is the art. I never tell somebody you have to do it this way because that's ridiculous. I never tell somebody that your behavior has to be, you need to prioritize and execute. Well, you may not need that as a behavior because maybe you just instinctively or naturally do that, but you procrastinate, right? So we've got to recognize that. Okay, now that's the behavior we need to work on that will make you better at everything else you're doing.
Just as important, or you antagonize, or you are abrupt. And the reality is that if you don't address those things, you're not going to be an effective leader. People don't want to follow somebody who's abrupt or abrasive. And that doesn't mean you have to make them like you.
That's right. And that's where that falls right into it. And I promise you, and I won't keep doing this throughout the thing, but it really to make a point, like when you say that, you know, if you're abrupt, if you're abrasive, well, where do we figure that out? We figure that out in cultural awareness and recognition, right? So when I coach people, you know, right, that second week is all around, you know, we've got them on our app that we developed so people can log in. What do they do? It's the hardest thing. And we'll ultimately come to a conclusion, right? Well, I find that when people don't come to me with all the facts, I yell at them and we'll go on. And we might come to that conclusion like, oh, so you're abrasive. That's what you do. Well, I don't mean to be. It's their fault. No. That's fault is not the issue. We're identifying what you do and you're abrasive based on what you just told me. So yeah,
that is the consequences of that.
And then it goes on and on. Right.
Yeah. That's funny. I think we probably coach in a very similar way. I have people tell me this story. Well, when this went wrong, when this went sideways, what happened in that conversation? What was said? What were you observing in the person in front of you? And I did have somebody once say, well, I don't care what people think. And I said, well, that's okay, as long as you're okay with the consequences of them thinking you're abrasive. And and if your ultimate goal is to be a great leader and to bring out the best in people, then you might have to rethink that.
Well, that just absolutely, and I'm sure we and that's the beauty of this business that we're in. We probably say very many of the same things. Who's it going to resonate with? And then that's our audience, right? So the things that I say may not resonate with many of your clients, and that's okay because vice versa. And that's the beauty of we're all out there just trying to help people make better. And if what we say resonates, come one, come all. And if I have somebody who's not resonating with me, I might be like, I know somebody for you. You know, give Sarah a call, right?
Because Well, we skipped my initial question that I usually ask my guests, and that is to share something about yourself that most people don't know. And I think the timing is actually really good for this in this context, because people have a feel for who you are already based on your coaching style. So I think it would be an interesting thing for you to answer that. Do you have something in mind that you could share?
Yeah, you know, there's a few things. The first thing is, it was a very hard question. Obviously, I listened to, a ton of your podcasts, and that's, that's a question you ask everybody. So I'm not going to pretend like you caught me off guard. because you didn't.
Thank you.
it's not an easy question. Maybe just not for me. The first reason is because I keep a very tight circle, and it's not because of any other reason than that's just kind of the way I've always been. I have a lot of friends. But if you asked my tight circle of friends, tell me something about Errol I don't know, they'd be like, Errol will tell us everything about himself. So maybe that's something that they don't. I'll just tell you everything.
Yeah.
but outside of that circle, not so much. So people might be, just from my background, former Navy SEAL, former FBI agent. Now, and you're listening to me talk and all these things, and to say, wow, you lead with things like emotions. I think that would surprise people that's my first go-to on a lot of things. But I would say in the immediate that nobody knows what I'm doing right now. I'm doing a little experiment with myself. I'm very into something called the Wim Hof method, which is breathing and cold exposure. And I implement that in my leadership practice. But I'm on a journey to do what I call 365 at 36.5. So I've got my own ice bath in the house, and we keep it nice and chilly in the 30s. And I do a full ice bath every day. And I'm really just starting to log, what time of the day, how does this affect me? What happens if perhaps we have a couple drinks the night before? What happens if I sleep in? And just, I really am now obsessed with how is this every day at this temperature, how is that going to affect my life? And I can tell you, with the state of the world that we're in right now, it's pretty serendipitous that it's happening, because it's a huge stress reliever, and it's a huge immunity builder. So that's one thing that nobody knows that I'm doing. So that's a kind of a combination answer. Does that fit the bill?
Absolutely. I love it. Ice baths. Wow. Yeah, that is not something that you would catch me doing with any intention at all.
Nope, we're going to get you there. If I have anything to do with it, we're going to get you in there.
Well, my friend, I live in Montana, so I have enough ice baths accidentally. but actually, it's funny you say that, because one of my friends had posted on Facebook that he was doing a 1 minute cold water at the end of his shower. He was turning the water to full on cold and doing that for 1 minute. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that's like. And so every once in a while, especially when it's going to be a hot day here in Montana, which that's not all that common, But and I'll take a hot shower and then I'll think, oh, actually cold water sounds really good right now. And I'll turn it to cold and let it wash over me. And it does definitely kind of give me a little jump start.
Yeah,
but as far as like intentionally getting into a bath full of ice, I don't think so.
Well, but that's good. That's a good start, right? That's the way I start people. I don't, you know, I don't say you don't have to start by getting to a 32 degrees ice bath. A cold part, you know, 1 minute at the end of your shower, just fine. See, so you look at that. You didn't even know it, but you were right in there. You're already doing the Wim Hof method.
Yeah, well, there's something to be said for trying something new.
That's right.
To get different results. I actually just did a Facebook Live of that this morning when I was up on the mountain behind my house. I mentioned the fact that I find that different areas inspire different emotion and different sensibilities. And so when I was on the beach in February, we spent the whole month of February in Central Coast, California. And I anticipated doing a lot of writing because I thought I'd be inspired by the ocean, because mm-hmm. I am very connected to the ocean, even though I don't live anywhere near it. And all month long, I kept waiting for inspiration to hit, and it just didn't. I was feeling very calm. I was feeling very present. That was what really happened. And I actually had a little bit of a sense of urgency as I was there, but not necessarily creative inspiration to write or create content. And then we got home after a whole month of being in California. I got up on the mountain with my dog and I'm hiking straight up one of the steepest trails on our mountain in my special shoes with spikes on them because there's ice and snow here. And because it was first week of March. And I remember within maybe 15 minutes getting my heart rate up and hitting one of the plateaus and then heading up another incline, I was barraged with ideas and inspiration. And I realized that when I go to the city, I have different kinds of inspiration, and the mountains and the beach and different people inspire me in different ways, different conversations. And I think one of the things we get kind of complacent and stay in one place, and then we wonder why we can't make the changes we want to make.
Well, that's exactly right. And when we talk about the science behind the behavioral change and things like that, and that's an awesome story. We could pick that story apart for hours, but you know, there's some studies in neuroscience around the brain. And one of the studies shows that we have between 60 and 70,000 thoughts per day. And 80 to 90% of those thoughts are the same as the day before. And the studies further show that about 70% of those are related to the emotions of stress, frustration, anger, worthlessness, whatever they are. So if you just extrapolate that forward and not back, well, we're thinking the same thing we thought yesterday, today, and pretty by and large, and it's generally things related to the negative emotions of stress. And we wonder why things don't change. Right. We just, oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe
there's
it.
An eye there.
Right. I mean, it's science, but it doesn't appear to be rocket science. It makes perfect sense. So when you tell the story about there's just so much to, you went somewhere to be inspired. You couldn't find the inspiration because we can't force inspiration, but other things were happening. You were very present in the moment. You were a place where you were connected. And I just kind of, just by the way it sounds, you were just in a deep meditative state. And it wasn't until you got out of that deep meditative state when you left and were up on the mountain that, bam, it all hit you. You had to be, so there was a form of inspiration, but you just got to a different place to let all that subconscious, you know, all that energy start to flow after you left. And that's to your point. Just for God's sake, sometimes just getting a change of venue. Change up your surroundings, because something will happen. If you do something different, something different will happen. That's a guarantee.
Exactly. And that could be as simple as introducing yourself to somebody that you find interesting online. So it does, because of the current circumstances, you may not be able to go somewhere that's really different. I can say that most people have that access, even if it's just a 1 hour drive. But if you can't do that, if that's not really in the cards for you, there are all kinds of ways to change your environment, even down to taking a webinar on a topic that you've never really been interested in. or listening into a podcast that you've never heard before, especially if you're not a podcast listener, or you know, anything just to change your environment in some way.
How about this? How about turn off the TV for the day, right? How about walk around the block because you're not watching the TV? You don't even have to go anywhere to change your environment. You are just literally thinking about something else. The environment is not the same when the TV's on as when it's off. You could be in the same room with everything surrounding you. You turn off the mind-numbing television and you pick up a book.
Oh my gosh, a book?
Can you imagine that? That will change everything.
You know what I love about picking up a book is that it doesn't have to be literature. It doesn't have to be nonfiction. I find that there are days when I just want to read something kind of mindless and I'll pick up like a young adult novel. So for instance, the trilogy of Inkheart trilogy. It was this amazing, magical book. Or Peter and the Starcatchers. They're written for preteens and teenagers. And I just find that if you can lose yourself like that, just, what was that movie? Oh, Never Ending Story. Do you remember that?
Yes,
that
sounds indeed.
Stuck in my head. But reading something that you wouldn't normally pick up and losing yourself in a book. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
again, it's just the environment. And look, I'm not so sure that if you're an avid reader, I would tell you to put down the book and turn on the television. However, it does go to the spirit, right? There's nothing like a nice movie sometimes to lose yourself. But again, to your point, if we're looking for something different, we have to do something different. And you know, your story about just getting out and trying to find inspiration to a place that you're drawn to, that inspiration came, it just came on its own time, but just because you did something different, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's get to part of your story. We've heard enough about mine. What I would love to ask you is, when you think about where the inspiration came for this book, I'm guessing that something in particular, like a conversation you had or a situation where you walked away going, oh my gosh, that was a really important aha moment. Maybe months later, you look back at that incident. Can you think of something in particular, a specific time that kind of made you realize, I have a book in me and this is something that has to happen?
Yeah, I mean, like most books, it comes from a series of things that build up over time. And then there's that one instance that says, okay, this is it. So back when I was 4 years old, Sarah, let's start there. No, I won't do that to you. I will say that leadership, for one reason or another, has always been a very important part of my life. And I will share a four-year-old story, but then I'll get to the event that led to the book. I played hockey growing up. I started, my parents were crazy. I started playing hockey when I was four. And so when I was about six, right, you get to be pretty good because you've been playing it for a while, right? So I was named captain of those little teams, and we're just kids, for God's sakes. And so it was before a game one day, and my dad says to me, well, what are you going to say to the boys? And I said, what do you mean, what am I going to say to the boys? He said, well, you're the captain, and it's before the game, and they need to hear from you. I said, hear what? I was six. Right? They hear what? I said, it doesn't matter. He says, they look to you for leadership. Now go talk to them, give them a pep talk, and let's get, you know, okay.
So, tell them they're going to win.
Yeah. Right, hey, let's go. Whatever 6 or 7 year olds say, but that, I'll never forget that. And I don't know if that was the beginning of the importance of leadership, but in any event, there's a series of ups and downs through life, and I certainly had my share. And each time I was saved because somebody came up and said, look, he's making some mistakes, but he's worth saving. He's an excellent leader. We're gonna move him along. We're gonna help him out. So you go through those ups and downs. When I was in the Navy, I had a few of them. When I was in college, I had a few. I went to the Naval Academy. So I was kind of in an environment where if you made some mistakes, they were gonna, you were gonna account for them. Couldn't just get away with them. And so I started to make some real corrections after I left the SEAL teams. I left the SEAL teams after an injury. I wanted to be a SEAL for my entire life. And I had just, again, made a couple errors. In, you know, my injury was something different. But I left there going, man, I feel like I didn't make the most of something that meant the world to me. And that's when I started that real journey of self-reflection. You know, and that's when I started to understand a little bit more about process. You know, what was I doing when things went right? What was I doing when things went wrong? In any event, I joined the FBI and I started to see things. Now, I loved being an FBI agent. Let me just, I'm not going to take a gratuitous shot at the FBI because I loved the actual job of being a special agent. I worked counterterrorism mostly. I traveled the world. I worked with law enforcement and intelligence agencies around the world. Just did incredible things. I loved it. However, what I was seeing in the FBI was an environment that was void of leadership. And anything that you think good about leadership, I was finding too much of the opposite. And, you know, you start to ignore things because it's not for you. It's not for you to get involved. You can't change it, right? All that stuff until the laser, so to speak, until the target is put on your back. And so I had a target put on my back. Now, with all the challenges that I faced in my life, one thing that anybody would ever say about me was Errol Dobler never shied away from taking ownership for the things that he did wrong. We never had to drag it out of him. We'd say, Errol, did you do this? He'd be like, yep. And let me tell you what else I did. Right. If there's one thing, enemies and foes and friends, they'll all say that about me. And when if I earned my trouble, I said, I earned that. Nobody did that to me. I did that to myself. That was not the case in the FBI. And I didn't earn any of it. As a matter of fact, it was the opposite. I was actually doing some very good things. And there was just some of those problems that I saw, the bad leadership, whether it's jealousy, ego, whatever it is. And then so once the target was on my back and I was forced to defend myself in ways that I just didn't think, it just was frustrating. So once, you know, the objective observers came in and said, you know, Errol, you're right. You haven't done anything wrong. As a matter of fact, you two who did this to Errol, come with us. That's when I said, okay, now I'm quitting. I'm leaving because I value leadership so much and this is too hard to endure. I can't sit back anymore and endure it and pretend I don't see it. And I'm certainly not in a position to make any changes in this huge bureaucracy. So it's time to put my money where my mouth is and focus on helping people who care about leadership. And then once you start your business, you know, it takes a little while to get your thoughts in order. You know, you've got to mm-hmm. like, okay, what do I believe? Right? Right. So that's right. When I really put what's it all next? Together, process. Here's when it went right. Here's when it went wrong. Here are the things that were consistent. And then once you start honing that, and then I said, you know, now I've got it. I think I've got a book that people are going to care about. It's personal stories. It's stories about, look at how I messed this up. And now let's put this to the process. And if you follow this, you know, and so that's kind of it in a nutshell. If that's a nutshell, it's a big nut, but.
Well, I have a couple of things that I'd like to kind of dig into a little bit. I'm imagining you as a 6-year-old and, I have a 6-year-old niece. So it feels very clear to me. And I have two boys, but they're much bigger. So I'm trying to remember them at 6 years old. But I'm imagining you at 6 and you're the captain of the hockey team. And what did your dad do that he would say something like that to you? Because not every parent has that kind of insight.
Yeah, I tell you, Sarah, that's an excellent question. You know, my dad was, he was an athlete, but by his own admission, not a very good one. So he enjoyed playing sports. He, you know, he played soccer. He played lacrosse. He was you know, my dad passed away several years ago and he and I were very, very close. That was a very hard time for me. So, you know, he was an interesting guy. I think he was like 15 years younger than the next sibling. So he was a mistake and he got shipped off to boarding school and stuff like that. So he didn't, you know, he didn't have that love and attention that he gave me. He was in the army, but only for a couple of years. He was drafted, you know, kind of in between wars. He never saw combat, but he always spoke very highly of his time. in the Army. So, and then he was a lobbyist. He was a lobbyist for the New York Con Edison, which is the New York City electric company. So he was in politics a lot, and he saw a lot of bad behavior in politics. But to say like, oh yeah, and my dad was, you know, he was a general in the Air Force during Vietnam. No, it was nothing like that. So I don't know. I don't know, but I know he cared about that. He cared about being a gentleman. He cared about being a representative of yourself in the most positive way. That I can tell you for certain. And now that I'm kind of reflecting, maybe he just saw a role. How does somebody who wears a C on their jersey, even if they're six, how are they supposed to properly represent themselves? And that's probably what he saw. And I've never even really put that together, because I've often thought, what did make him say that to me?
I get the sense that he had a sense of responsibility, and that was more, I mean, just from the way that you're talking about him and his experiences, it feels more like he was looking at you and realizing that you had a responsibility, and he recognized that. He didn't necessarily know what that looked like from your perspective, but he knew that you had a responsibility, and his sense of that was, that's what he was projecting to you.
Yeah, I'm quite certain you're right. And again, he recognized responsibility. He recognized, I think, how are we supposed to represent ourselves inside of those responsibilities? And now it's my job to do these things as a father, because I didn't have somebody doing them for me. He did not whine about what happened, right? So he got sent off to boarding school, probably the best boarding school in the country. But, you know, look, it's one thing about today when people talk about their challenges, we're making it competition sometimes, I feel like. And you say, well, gosh, your poor dad who went to this very rich boarding school. Okay, well, I suppose, would I rather be poor with parents who are there for me and love me, or would I rather be rich and never even really know my parents? Right. Is that what we're doing? Are we making it a competition? So I think that he didn't enjoy that. I think that he, and especially given how much he enjoyed being my father, I sense that he looked back and wished that he had had the same thing. And he was bound and determined to make sure that he was a very strong presence in my life all the time. And he was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that struggle is relative, and I don't compare struggle. I really look at your behavior as a result of your struggle, regardless of what that struggle was.
Yeah.
That's why I listen to people's stories. That's why I find them so compelling and love them so much, is because those stories are all relative, and whatever you learn from them is really what's going to take you to that next step. And in your dad's case, he learned exactly what he didn't want in his child's life by experiencing what he did.
Yeah. I agree with that. And as long as we can take that attitude with people, and especially again in our business, if we don't take that attitude, then we're going to be very bad at it, because then we start judging, and judging is not what people come to us for, right? They come to us for some perspective, some objectivity, a little compassion, a little empathy. Judgment is certainly not it. So that's for certain. And I hope that I take the same stance that you just described when I listen to people, because I hope I do. I try to anyway.
Well, you know, the reality is that you are not going to make a positive impact when you approach it with a sense of judgment versus curiosity. And I know that because I'm one of those people that as soon as there's that kind of attitude toward me, I shut down. You're not going to get past that first layer as long as you're looking at me with some form of judgment or insulting me in some way. You lose all possibility of positive impact when you do that.
Well, and likewise, when you do it with yourself, right? So like we talk about, again, I love bringing everything back to my process, right? But that cultural awareness and recognition, you have to look at what you do without judgment. For God's sakes, what's the point? Like, we don't judge yourself either. If you did something and you don't like it, acknowledge it and then make positive adjustment going forward. So, okay, I see that I do this. I'm going to give everything in my being to do the opposite or do this that will mitigate that, you know. Mm-hmm. But whether we're hearing judgment from somebody else or we're hearing it from ourselves, there's zero upside.
Right, right. Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have three sisters. I have three older sisters.
Oh my goodness. No wonder your dad was so present.
I was the youngest. Yeah. They'll, wow. You know, they give me good humor, hard time, that, you know, they all were always at my events because that's where dad was going to be. So everybody got to follow along, but they, you know, I get on okay with my sisters, but yeah, they like to rib me a little bit for that on our upbringing. But
well, I always have to ask because I think oftentimes our parents have those experiences with our older siblings and it shifts how they behave toward us. And I never really thought about that until I made mistakes with our older son and I would do something and just kick myself for days. Mm-hmm. Like, why did I do that? Boy, there goes that Mother of the Year award again.
Well,
and, yeah. But then, you know, a year later, 2 years later, because his younger brother is 2.5 years younger than he is, I would see a situation that felt familiar and I'd handle it differently. And I'd be so proud of myself. Like, okay, did that okay. And then, you know, there goes my older son with another oops. And then the younger son, oh, I'm going to handle that differently. So poor older son.
You know, I got a little bit of a late start. I've got a 7-year-old son, a 6-year-old daughter, and a 16-month-old daughter.
Oh my goodness.
So we are, you know, I am right in the middle of that. You know, now my son is starting to get out of that. You know, he's got that analytical mind going. Now he's understanding what he's doing, right? So hopefully we didn't mess him up too bad. You know, we gave him a lot of positive affirmation going forward. So that's his subconscious, you know, being. But yeah, it's absolutely true. Even just the year and change difference between my son and my daughter, he'll do something and God, he takes the brunt of all my bad parenting. And then sure enough, yeah, when my daughter does, I'm like, all right, well, I'm not doing that to her because that poor kid just got it. So, you know, but then I try to go give him extra hugs, you know, and be like, God, I'm so sorry. But that's one thing that that you know, I take away from my upbringing. We didn't do a lot of I'm sorry's in my house. Not that people didn't feel like they were sorry. It just wasn't a lot of that. There wasn't a lot of I love yous and it wasn't a lot of I'm sorry's. So I probably overcompensate for that, but can you really overcompensate by saying
no.
I love you too much and saying I'm sorry too much? You know, I don't think you can overcompensate.
You right. can't. And I love that you just said that because that is something that I make sure I do. And I think it's part of why our kids take responsibility for themselves and their actions is because I always say, oh gosh, I didn't handle that well. I'm sorry.
And it's hard. It's hard to do.
It is. It sucks to admit that you've done something that hurt somebody in some way. As a matter of fact, I've told this story before where I was driving our older son to seventh grade one morning, and seventh grade, like middle school, just so awful. It's so awful. And he was really, really struggling academically, and there were some bullies. And I remember one morning, it was a Monday morning, and I'm driving him to school, and he gets in the car with this, he's like buoyant, and he said, this is going to be a good week. I just know it. And I thought, oh my gosh, yay, I love this attitude, because, you know, that's kind of how I live. Right. And so I said, oh, that's great. That means you're going to talk to your math teacher about getting that math homework in this week, right? And he's like, yeah. and then I said, oh, and you know, you're not going to get detention this week because you're going to turn in your work. And he's like, yeah. And then I see him like deflating in front of my eyes. I keep digging and I'm trying to stop myself. And I just keep on digging because I want to fix it.
That's right. Because these are all the things that you want to have a good week that he does.
Exactly. Right. So by the time he got out of the car, I mean, it's a short drive. We live in a small town. It doesn't take long to get anywhere. But he gets out of the car and he puts his backpack on. And I said, love you, honey. And he reaches across, gives me a kiss, and then deflated walks into the school. And I will never forget. I cried all the way to work that morning. I felt like a horrible, horrible mother. And believe me, I learned the lesson because 2 years later, when I said something to our younger son, I just said the words and then I stopped. Mm-hmm. I said, this is your choice. And then I got quiet, decided that I couldn't dig any deeper.
Yeah.
But that day I got to work and I had been crying and my boss was horrible. And she just gave me a nasty look, and because my eyes were puffy and red, which is, you know, you'd think that somebody would be concerned about that. But
Right. Anyway,
so I called the school and I told them that he had a dentist appointment at lunchtime. I was going to come get him. Could they send him outside? And he comes out to the car and he says, Mom, I don't remember having a dentist appointment. I said, you don't, but I want to take you out to lunch. And Right. He said, why? And I said, well, I feel really bad about this morning. I'm sorry that I didn't just be quiet and listen to you and be happy that you were in a good mood. And he's like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, you know what? He probably didn't remember, but he did, right? Just like kids do, and it goes somewhere. So bravo. I feel like we might be kindred spirits in that sense, because I got on my son. You know, he didn't deserve it, right? I was probably having a bad morning, and we dropped him off at, for God's sakes, preschool, right? So, and I was devastated. And I came home and I said, I'm going to get him. We're going to go ice skating. I'm going to go take him ice skating in the middle of the day. And I just, you know, I walked in, I'm like, yeah, hey, I've got to pick up Henry. And they're like, is everything okay? I'm like, yep, everything's okay. And he, you know, I did the same thing. I said, buddy, I was so rude to you this morning. I'm sorry. He's like, can I have ice cream? Right. He didn't. So we did. I apologize. He had no idea what I was talking. But you know, look, if that goes on too much, they'll remember. It's going to be housed somewhere, and that's not what we want. So yeah, we have that guilt going.
Yes, definitely. And I have to come back because I'm putting something together in the timing of your book, your father's death, and the birth of your first son. That seems to me that it was all within a couple of years. Is that accurate?
Well, gosh, let's see. I can tell you what happened. My dad died about 6 years ago. My daughter was born. Her birthday's coming up July 22nd. My father died a day after or so after his birthday. His birthday is August 1st. So I think he died August 3rd. So, you know, picture this, right? So we just have my daughter. We have a one-year-old. He's at hospice, you know, and we got really lucky there. They were wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's almost 6 years. Well, it's almost 6 years to the day. Yeah. It'll be a month off of 6 years to the day that he died, that we released the book, which will be.
And when did you start writing it?
I started writing the book about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
So yeah, it took a couple of years or so to work it out. I had a copy done, and then I realized I recognized the science portion, and I said, this is too good. I have to redo it. But yeah, so that's the timing.
That's, and I have to go a little deeper into that, partly because I lost my dad in 2014 as well.
Mm.
Wow. And it was just a few months before my younger son's bar mitzvah. So he was turning 13 and having his bar mitzvah in June, and my father died in February. So I understand the grief of that connection between your children and the parent, between your child and your parent, to have that grief of loss that you want to share your parent so badly with your children. Especially because you were so close with him. And I have to ask if if you think back now, I mean, you wouldn't have known this at the time, but if you think back now to when you were writing this book and how your relationship with your father had shifted over the years from your childhood to your young adulthood and then to having one and a half kids and watching him with your children, it seems like the timing would be pretty it would be about 5 years after he died that you would have been writing this book. So is there something maybe that triggered, I don't know, it just seems like there's the connection there.
Yeah, no, I get it. The I can tell you that my father is always an influence in my life, and I'll explain that. When I talk about in my process the art, right? I think my father had the art of fatherhood like nobody else. And what do I mean by that? He still had all the things he expected of me, right? There was a process that he expected of me. He expected me to be a gentleman. He expected all of these things. But what really separated my father was that mine and his relationship evolved with my age. He treated me age appropriate at every age. Now, maybe every parent does that. Maybe they don't. But I started to recognize it. And I was like, man, this guy, how does he do it? You know, how does he know when to get off my back about some of these things where just last year he was on me? Well, because he recognized the difference between, I don't know, a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, and he adjusted. So that ability to be flexible inside of everything we do, inside of a very distinct process, and he definitely had his ideas about fatherhood. So in that, from that standpoint, it was incredibly impactful. I can tell you, if we had this conversation, I would never have made it through this conversation 2 years ago. It's only been recently that I've been able to have these good conversations. And that comes with, again, how am I acting? How do I want to act, right? What is my culture? What do I want my behaviors to be? And I had to work really hard at saying, look, I'm allowed to be sad, but I want to talk about him. And if I can't talk about him happily, that's a disservice to him. If every time somebody asks me about my father, I break down into tears, what good is that? And so that in and of itself allowed me to work hard at vulnerability, right? To say, hey, look, I'm really struggling with this issue, but I want to talk to you about it. Right? Can you bear with me? I have to practice. That's a skill. And that's a skill that he left me after he was gone. And that's a skill that I put into the book, right? Because it's it's that flexibility. It's that art inside of a very distinct and formulated process that really gets things done. The other thing that I would say is there's just eerie similarities. He would say, and it's irrespective, but now you have me talking about my dad, so I have to talk a little bit. But he was always so upset that me and his father weren't closer. Mm-hmm. And he would say, gosh, Errol, you guys would get along so well. It always bothered me. And so, you know, he died really not knowing my son. And I see my son now the way he is, his spirit, his sense of humor, especially. My dad was a very funny guy. And I think to myself, man, I really wish you got to know your grandfather. And so that's why I'm going to live to be 130, because I don't want my son to ever have to say to his child, I wish you got to know your grandfather better.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And especially because there are two things that kind of resonated really deeply with me is when you talked about the art of fatherhood and the art within process, I immediately went to the art of a shifting relationship. Mm-hmm. So our relationships must shift. Even with the same people our whole lives, our relationships shift. And there is an art to that. Yeah. As you'll see in long-term marriages, that you both are growing, you both are changing, you have to. And the relationship, no matter how solid it is, no matter what the relationship is, whether it's a parent-child or spouse or siblings, your relationships change, and there's an art to accessing that change and seeing the person for the identity that they are striving toward. Okay. And the reason I say that is I've studied a bit of the research going into storytelling, particularly family narratives. And there are researchers at Eastern Washington University that are studying the impact of storytelling on identity. And they studied pre-verbal years. So the stories that people tell about you before you even have words in front of you impact your identity. And then when you're in those ages, 17 to 22-ish, when you are really looking toward what you want your adult identity to be, and you're shifting your own personal narrative, and somebody else is telling stories about you that conflicts with that, that can really cause some major friction in your relationship. And that immediately came to mind when you started talking about the art of fatherhood and how your father could shift his relationship with you, even though it's still father-son, but at every age, at every developmental stage, your father intuitively knew that his relationship with you was shifting, and he had to allow for that and encourage it even.
Yeah, look, the power behind storytelling, and I love the premise of that for everything you're doing, is so impactful, and it's such a challenge. And me and my wife are constantly aware of that, right? So when I get mad at my kids for just not listening, you know, it's, and that's, by the way, another reason to get out there and be with other families and things like that, because you it's important to realize you're not alone. Your kids are not the only ones who don't listen, right? You're not family. First, let me just say that, right? So then you can lighten
Welcome
up.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, you can lighten up on yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, we do what we do sometimes as parents. We're not always our perfect selves, and we say things like, you know, you're just not listening, and I'm tired of saying this over and over again. And that's not the narrative we want. So we always go back and say, look, you didn't listen that time, and I did have to say it over and over again, but you are a good boy, you are a good girl, and you do listen a lot. We just have to work harder this time. You know, whatever it is, because I don't want him growing up or her growing up say, well, yeah, I just don't listen. That's just what I do. No, that's not. You'll never, you know, you didn't listen this time. Okay. Right. And it's a challenge because you can get lazy, right? So when we talk about being aware of what our emotions are and what we do on those emotions, if you're not aware, you'll let that stuff slip. And laziness will become now your pattern, your habit, and that will be a lazy story you tell your kids. That will be a lazy story you're telling the people who you are literally molding into the human beings that they are. So yes, that storytelling and the awareness around what's driving what story you're telling them, I don't know that there's anything else more important.
And I think there's a really important distinction that you just made, and you probably didn't even know. No, you made it, which was the difference between telling a story and labeling somebody. Mm-hmm. And there is a sociological term called labeling theory. And Mario McCracken, one of my podcast guests, was talking about that. If you label somebody a troublemaker, they are going to live up to that label.
That's right.
And so if you label somebody as a bad listener or a slob, they're going to live up to it. And then what the distinction is when you tell a story about somebody and you tell the same story over and over again. So for instance, I love to tell the story about how our older son would often be surprised when people were mean because he just didn't understand. He had no concept of why would anyone do that. And I tell the story about being at a playground where our older son had kind of enlisted the help of all these other kids that were a little younger than he was. He was 4 and he had a bunch of 3 and 4-year-olds kind of following his lead to build a dam at this water feature at a park in the Presidio in California, San Francisco. And they had built this really cool dam and they hadn't pushed the water button for this water feature because they were building this dam and getting ready to see what it would look like. And they had just pushed the button. The water had just started to come down. It was going to take a few seconds to reach where it was going. And it was just about to hit it. And this older kid that I had been watching bullying kids, stealing shovels and pails from other kids and kicking things and pushing kids off of other playground equipment, I saw him walk over toward Jacob and his buddies. And I was nursing the baby at the time, so I couldn't have gotten up and done anything about it. But the kid kicked the construction that they had just completed. And all the other little kids are looking at him, looking at the bully and looking at my son to figure out how to respond. And my son gets this big smile on his face and he goes, "Thanks, kid." And all the other kids are like, "Oh." So they smiled and you know, it was no big deal because that was what was supposed to happen, I guess. And boy, I kind of felt for the bully in a little bit of a way because he was so puzzled. He walked away with this. So that's a story. The label could be peacemaker. The label could be optimist. But the story that I tell really designs his identity in a different way.
That's right. It's what he did.
I love
it's
that.
Not the label that you put on him, right? Call it whatever you want. Peacemaker, you know, friendly kid. It doesn't matter.
Facilitator.
Because all that right, facilitator. All that matters is you can describe what he did, and that's what you just did. And that's kind of what, you know, that's kind of what we try to do around here. And that's what I talk about to my clients, but it's all the same, right? You know, around here, look, here's what we do. We are kind to each other. We listen to each other. We don't interrupt, you know, we support each other, you know, whatever it is. Right. And so in my mind, in at least in our family, and I encourage my clients to promote the same thing. There's got to be a series of those things. Okay. And when you get to the point where you could look at somebody after they had just done something and you say, that's not how we do business around here. Everybody goes, that's right. That's not how we do business around here. Right? Somebody listening in from the outside is like, what just happened? But everybody in there knows, yeah, that's what that person did. And that's not how we do it around here. You've got yourself a culture. Mm-hmm. Label it whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But what you do is what you do. And that's the most important. And I think that, you know, certainly validates the story about your son, right? Who cares what label that is? Because you still have to explain what he did, and that's the beauty. That's the beauty of the story.
And what are you going to tolerate? I mean, I love that example of being in a room where you're at a company where you say, "Oh, that's not how we do business.
That's just not how we do it."
It comes right back to the current circumstances around Black Lives Matter movement and all of the racism and bigotry that we are seeing being addressed finally after forever. That same thing has to happen in terms of what we choose not to tolerate. We have to use those words. Boy, that's not how we do things here.
Yeah. And look, and it's got to just simply start with the individual. I know that we have so many things that we want to just take one big broad brushstroke and fix. Well, guess what? It's not happening.
That's not going to happen.
And nobody likes to hear the hard truth that just do it yourself. If you think this is the way it's supposed to be done, then you do it. Okay. That's the best you have. Okay. Cause then you can influence what happens around you just by doing the story with your son. He did that. God knows what happened to that bully after that, right? Something happened. I guarantee you there was a shift. He walked away. He's like, well, that's not the reaction I'm supposed to get. I'm supposed to get people being afraid or crying. And I had somebody tell me, thank you. That's influence, right? And it's cliche, one person at a time, but that's it. That's all that's going to happen. Now, maybe there's that one person who can get up and say something and inspire us as individuals to do the right thing. But what are you doing?
I love that. I love that. So full circle.
Yep.
If, when our podcast listeners would like to reach out to you, first of all, what's the best way to get in touch with you or connect with you? And then tell me a little bit about the availability of the book in the near future.
So the book, by the time we have this goes live, the book will be up for sale. It's on for pre-order right now on Kindle. So, you know, assuming that you are not putting this on the air, the second we get done with this, the book will be for ready for order July 1st. Leader193.com is my website. So it's got a page for the book and everything like that and more about my business. And then of course the book will be on Amazon is the primary place for it to be. The Process, Art, and Science of Leadership. And then I'm on Instagram at Leader193. And those are the best places to come find me and more about me and to get the book.
Wonderful. Are you also on LinkedIn?
I am on LinkedIn. Yep.
Okay. So our guests or our listeners can also follow you there.
That's right.
So that's great. At Leader193 on Instagram and it's leader193.com.
Yep.
Okay. So for our listeners, I will have a blog post associated with this podcast with the show notes, and I will have links to Errol's information. And hopefully we will see that book in the very near future so that we can maybe do a recap of this conversation and make sure that people know more about your book when it's available.
That would It would certainly be my honor. So thanks very much. I appreciate everything, Sarah. This has been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thanks, Errol.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Could you tell me that you're going away?